Welcome to the MJA podcast. I'm chatting today with Dr. Zane Kassam, who is the Chief Medical Officer at Open Biome, and he's also a research affiliate with the world-famous MIT in the United States. Hello, Zane. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much, Kate. Really excited to have a chance to speak with you.
Terrific. Tell us a little bit about Open Biome.
Sure. Open Biome is a nonprofit stool bank. Think of it a little bit like a blood bank, but for stool.
Okay.
So we screen healthy donors through a rigorous screening process. Only about 2.8% of prospective donors qualify, so it's easier to get into Harvard than be a poop donor, believe it or not. from there, we take the material and process it under high-quality conditions, or GMP conditions, pull out the key bacteria, freeze it, and then ship it off to clinicians kind of all around the world. To date, we've treated over 25,000 patients in collaboration with clinicians all around the U.S. and abroad. Our goals are twofold: one, to kind of provide safe access to fecal transplants, and the second is to catalyze research in the microbiome. So we're involved in about 25 clinical trials at the moment and excited to help kind of move this field forward.
Let's talk about fecal transplants, because we're pretty fascinated by them here at the MJA. Tell us, obviously, we're talking about using them for treatment for C. difficile, aren't we?
Yes, that's right. And so the overwhelming amount of evidence for fecal transplants are in recurrent Clostridium difficile infection.
Mm-hmm.
So data, for example, that I helped lead, a systematic review meta-analysis that we published, suggests that fecal transplants are effective for recurrent Clostridium difficile in about 89% of patients, which is remarkable. You know, as a clinician, there's fewer things in medicine that are a miracle than clearly nearly 90% clinical cure rate. That said, that's kind of where the heart of the data is. There's
mm-hmm.
certainly emerging data in other areas, including inflammatory bowel disease, and in particular, ulcerative colitis, where actually Australia has led the way. Both Sam Costello and Michael Cam's group both have completed randomized controlled trials in ulcerative colitis, in addition to kind of our group in Canada, was led by Paul Moyetti, which have shown very, very promising data for fecal transplants and ulcerative colitis. But the vast majority of practice clinically day-to-day is happening in C. diff, as it should be, because I think right now it's a bit too early for moving it into other diseases.
Right. Tell us a little bit about how FMTs can be delivered.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways to administer a fecal transplant. So the upper GI tract, so one can deliver the material via nasoduodenal tube, a nasogastric tube, or upper endoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
The lower GI tract can deliver the material via a colonoscopy. That's the most common. About two-thirds of fecal transplants go via colonoscopy or flexible sigmoidoscopy.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, it can be delivered by a retention enema. More recently, there's been an emergence of fecal transplant capsules, so encapsulated microbiota, and that's something that's emerged very, very recently. Papers published by Elizabeth Holman at Mass General in JAMA, and certainly actually some of our work using fecal transplant capsules in clinical practice. And that's been very exciting to be able to provide the material in a little bit more patient-friendly way without a procedure,
mm-hmm.
Yet still maintaining a very high clinical cure rate.
So you've co-authored a short report for the MJA about the group of patients who don't respond to a transplant, at least not the first time. Tell us a little bit about the research you did and why it needed doing.
I spoke to the fact that fecal transplants are remarkably effective among patients with recurrent C. diff. But what's really fascinating is the percentage of patients that don't respond.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I mentioned, you know, between 10 and 20% of patients don't have a clinical response. And the only way to really start to navigate the underlying mechanisms potentially is to explore why they may not work. And the first step for us was diving into the data of what are the key kind of characteristics of patients. Are there any key common themes among patients that don't respond as a first starting point to look into the underlying mechanisms of a fecal transplant. And we're very privileged to have a very, very large data set. And because it's such a rare occurrence for patients not to respond, using the wealth of data that are possible and aggregating it gives us a unique opportunity to dive into factors that may be helpful for clinicians on a day-to-day basis to predict patients that may not respond. So what we did is we looked actually, just to kind of give some context, at over 1,800 fecal transplant outcomes, amongst which, you know, about an 84% clinical cure rate. But we dove into the patient that didn't respond. Amongst those, the 295 that didn't respond, 135 non-responders we're able to get back data on. And that's kind of data received from about 74 healthcare institutions in 27 U.S. states and the Netherlands. And what we found was interesting. I would say there's probably three lessons that I learned from this data amongst the 135 non-responders. So the first is some physicians who perform fecal transplants by the nasogastric route actually did not provide pre-treatment PTI. And so about 20% of clinicians would administer fecal transplants into the upper GI tract, into the stomach specifically, without a PPI.
A proton pump inhibitor, in other words, yeah.
That's right, that's right. And that's a problem because we know that stomach acid has a tremendous impact on disturbing gut microbiota. So standard of practice, or the emerging standard of practice, is to provide a pre-treatment with a proton pump inhibitor to decrease the acid. And so when you infuse that healthy microbiota, it doesn't immediately be destroyed, so to speak, in the stomach. So that might be one of the reasons why the clinical cure rate would be lower is the fact that, you know, roughly about 20% of folks that were doing NG tube delivery were not delivering the material with a PPI.
What was the second reason?
The second reason, that's the thing that was interesting that I learned about, was that about 20% of non-responders did not get counseled on decontaminating high-touch surface areas like toilets. And one of the key challenges is patients that have C. diff, they spread a lot of their spores, and they're hardy, kind of robust spores in their environment.
Yeah.
And that means that patients can then pick that up again, so getting reinfected. So whether it didn't work or whether they had a recurrence, because it was truly a reinfection from the spores that were in their toilets or on their bathroom, kind of picking up the infection in their environment was another key factor. And so, you know, it's another point for clinicians to think about is it's counseling patients to clean high-touch surface areas, or counseling their patients to clean high-touch surface areas like toilets, so that we can eliminate the spores and prevent reinfection that may be driving some of this non-responsive kind of phenotype. The third thing that we learned that I thought was also interesting was only about 30% of patients were assessed for post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome in their workup for non-response. And I think that's really, really important for a couple of different reasons. So first of all, post-infectious IBS is very common after C. diff.
Yeah.
Up to about 30% of patients will experience it. And what's tricky about this condition is it's very difficult to tell between post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome with C. diff carriage or colonization from true recurrence. Because a PCR test in this context is oversensitive. And we know that one can have be colonized with C. diff and have no diarrhea, have no C. diff symptoms. But when you have a positive PCR test plus diarrhea from another source, whether that's post-infectious IBS or laxative, it can seem like there hasn't been a clinical cure.
Right.
And so really the emerging standard of care with testing for C. diff actually is a two-step approach now. The new estimate guidelines by Kronbach et al. Suggesting a highly sensitive test, like a PCR or a GDH-EIA, and then reflexing that to a very specific test, which is a toxin ABEIA. And only if you have a positive toxin test do you really feel that the diagnosis is confirmed. And I think that's something that's emerging that clinicians have to be aware of, is actually making sure we follow up with a toxin test to confirm this. Because having the bug that may have the genes for the toxin but actually not producing any toxin may just be simply carried through colonization. And that's been demonstrated by Polage et al. And a number of others confirming this work.
FMT's been very broadly taken up, hasn't it? Are there guidelines available? Has it got to the point yet where somebody's actually written down what we should and should not be doing?
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And I think this is some of the areas. The guidelines are most powerful when there's a body of evidence, evidence-based guidelines. At the moment, there are consensus-based guidelines that was published in the Gut, a European group. There haven't been, and there's been an FMT work group consensus-based guidelines in the U.S. That's a little bit out of date now, in 2011. But what the challenge has been so far is that there hasn't been really enough robust evidence that's starting to come out now rapidly, with now about 8 randomized controlled trials in the field, in C. diff. And I think we're moving towards creating and crafting standard guidelines. I sit on the American Gastroenterology Association Strategic Advisory Board for the Center for Gut Microbiome Research and Education. And that's something that we've been starting to talk about a little bit, is moving towards thinking about practice guidelines, clinical guidelines. And they've set up an FMT registry, a very large registry they plan to move forward with, to look at about 10,000 patients, sorry, 4,000 patients over about 10 years. And then also set up kind of educational forums. So there's a conference to talk about kind of standard practices that are happening next year. And I think, to your point, I think we're on the cusp of having enough information truly to make an evidence-based guideline and move beyond consensus-based guidelines.
Obviously, follow-up is very important. What role do family physicians play in following up transplants and C. diff infections?
I think there's three particular roles in particular, and they're critical. So first is antibiotic stewardship. So making sure that patients are empowered to be careful about liberal use of antibiotics, trying to think through, is an antibiotic necessary? If yes, can it be narrow spectrum? Can it be topical? And really thinking thoughtfully about antibiotic stewardship. Two, counseling, as I mentioned, around cleaning of high-touch surface areas. I think that's really, really important in a public health practice. Three, actually, is patients that have recurrent C. diff almost have a little bit of PTSD about a little bit of diarrhea coming back and worried about this cycle of recurrent clustering to the seal. And so reassurance about that, as well as appropriate testing. And I think testing with EIA, as I was mentioning, with a two-step approach will help that, and being thoughtful about when to test. And I think those are the three pieces where I think in particular family physicians have a lot of power to kind of shape a patient's clinical course. Interesting about fecal transplants and C. diff, and I spoke of antibiotic stewardship as well, is it's its role actually in other antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And what I think is really, really interesting is, this is emerging data that we presented at ID Week, is that there may be, in fact, a role for decolonization of other antibiotic-resistant bacteria, things like VRE and CRE, which is very, very fascinating. I think infection control has had no real intervention beyond quarantining. And I think what's promising about fecal transplants is, and the data is so early, is that it may in fact have the potential to decolonize patients that have multi-drug resistant infections beyond C. diff through a process of outcompeting those organisms. And I think that's very, very exciting for clinicians, for public health practitioners, and for infection control stewards. And I think, you know, we're moving forward. We've got, in collaboration with the CDC, funding to start a prospective placebo-controlled randomized controlled trial for treatment of colonization of vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. And I think we're still just on the cusp of learning about the microbiome beyond C. diff. And I think C. diff is just kind of the tip of the iceberg, but we're really excited to kind of move this field forward. It's a journey that we're going to continue to evolve over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for reaching out. I really appreciate it.